Hi, everyone. This is a bonus episode to Brewing for Good, our conversation with Pat and Dan Conway of Great Lakes Brewing Company. If you listened to our first episode and were curious to hear the story about how the Conway brothers got interested in brewing and how that led to their opening of the first microbrewery in Ohio, then this is for you. It's a fascinating story that reveals some interesting insights about these two entrepreneurs and the Ohio City neighborhood.
You recycled an old building or two to start your brewery.
Or three or four.
Tell us about the history of these buildings, which I hear are haunted.
Yeah, we looked around the city for a building that would match our needs, and it was difficult. But we ended up picking these structures on Market Avenue, and it was kind of not as easy as you would expect. The buildings were abandoned and boarded up, but we told the landlord we had this idea of building this restaurant and a brewery, and it was a concept, its time had come, and he had no interest in it. And he said, I'll just keep the buildings boarded, and then when the market changes and the neighborhood changes, I'll sell the buildings at a higher rate. And we said, but that won't happen until somebody becomes a catalyst for the neighborhood, and that's us. And so he reluctantly leased us the building, and then we took off from there. Actually, he wanted us to buy the structures, but we had 3 5-year options, and we were pleased with the rent, and we had no interest, but then he went bankrupt, so we bought the buildings at the sheriff's sale.
Oh, my goodness. So, wow.
Mm. Well, and actually, what came with the buildings was the big Fries and Scheele building behind us, which was also his real estate, and it was perfect because when we needed to expand a couple of years later, we used the Fries and Scheele for our second brewery.
Is that where the production facility is? Is that off of Carroll Avenue?
No, it's that's where we are now. So,
oh, okay.
So this one is on 26th Street. It was an old department store. It's the white story, 5-story building there. So when we got it, it was vacant, and we used the first floor for brewing. First it was just aging, and then it was packaging, and then it was brewing. And then we had grain on the second floor, and we kind of kept growing into it until we realized this can't keep going in this footprint of a building, right? So
it was a department store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was not made for a production brewery.
Yeah.
In fact, that picture, that sign that's being touched up on our beer garden that you just saw moments ago, was also a synchronic event. It beckoned us. It meant you need to be here, because that sign said Lloyd and Keys, Kennett Ales and Porters on draft for family and medicinal purposes, Dan Rogers proprietor. Those were two breweries in Cleveland in the middle part of the 19th century. So it's all ales, porters, and stouts that they were making until the German immigrants came, and then everything became lagers. So it's a historically important piece of art.
Hmm. So we ended up selling the Fries and Scheele, that big 5-story building, and that became residential.
Mm-hmm.
And they added like townhomes to it, but then we moved. Well, I guess we didn't move right away. We put a pipeline under the street between the Fries and Scheele building and the Schlatter plant, so we would brew it and age it, and brew it and then age it in the tanks in the new facility. And so we were kind of able to phase into it, you know, over time instead of just cutting the tie abruptly like that. So that was nice.
And in fact, those beer lines are still under the street. So our brew pub. Why make the Dortmunder when we're already making it in our production brewery? So we pump beer underneath the streets and fill the tanks in the pub's cellar. And so when you're drinking the draft of the Dortmunder and our other production year-round beers, they actually come from across the street underneath the pipe. I'm not going to tell you where the pipe is, okay?
Okay. So illicit tappers
might
be
later.
The legacy of brewing was a sign that you were onto something, I think, at the right place at the right time. But at the time, back in the 80s, Ohio City wasn't what it was today. It was the West Side Market and
St. Ignatius,
and not a whole lot else going on.
And Lutheran, yeah, that was the three.
Yeah, it was a moribund part of the city. In fact, across the street was the Communist Study Club bookstore, and then there was a couple buildings over was a bar called Club Trash that went out of business. Then it became Babylon A Go-Go, and that went out of business. And they had a couple of shootings, and it was a pretty rough and tumble part of the city. And then the park across the street was also a rough and tumble part of the city's landscape here. But you know, things have changed dramatically. There's mm-hmm. a 10-story building going up across the street. There's apartments booming by the hour, it seems. And mm-hmm. so we are the first ones to put our flag in the ground and say we're going to make this difference to this neighborhood. And so a lot of the success of our company is based on urban renewal efforts, too. So.
Well, you can't have a renaissance without a good beer.
That's right.
And you've really contributed to the renaissance of this neighborhood. Now it's a very happening place to be. And so what personal influences led you to both, one, want to work together as brothers to start this company and to do it in the way that you did it in terms of investing in the neighborhood and all the good that that brought about?
Well, I had been thinking about this brewery concept for years. I had gone to school in Rome for a year at Loyola University, and not that Rome is the hotbed of beer consumption, because it isn't. It's still a wine-based culture like Greece, but, you know, a short train ride north over the Alps, you're into Germany and Austria and Czechoslovakia and then over to Britain. And those beers were just so fantastic and so fresh. You know, the ubiquitous neighborhood brewery. You know, they didn't have the mass-produced. Well, they did, but they also had neighborhood breweries that had the exquisite beers. Dan went to the same school 10 years after me, or maybe it was 12 years, but he experienced what I had experienced. So when I was in graduate school in Chicago, I was bartending and selling a lot of imported beers like Heineken and Curran and Guinness. And so it seemed like there was a change in the American palate. So I started thinking, wouldn't it be great to have a neighborhood brewery just like they've had in Europe? And so when I moved back to from Chicago to Cleveland, I was telling Dan about the concept, and he was working at a local bank as a loan officer. And so Dan said, well, I could help you with your business plan because I do deals all the time. So then,
yeah, I was at Huntington Bank. I was an English major in undergrad at Carroll, and then did the year abroad, like Pat said. But I had a feeling that writing poetry wasn't going to pay the bills. So, but I, at that time in the early to mid 80s, the local economy was really going through a pretty big change, as you recall, right? Like automotive was on the decline. The Japanese imports were going up. In fact, I had an internship at the Cuyahoga County, and my job was to do this survey with local automotive suppliers. And so I would be calling everybody from Eaton to the lowest, smallest job shop, and to try to get them to come to a conference about the Japanese way of making automobiles. So the local job shop guy would, like, go to hell, you know, slam the phone on me, and then the Eaton guy would be like, oh, yeah, we already know. So it was a pretty interesting survey to kind of get the pulse on what was going on with our local economy back then. Huh. But so the point I'm leading to is that the local city fathers were really saying that we need a big emphasis on entrepreneurship and small business, and that was really my interest. I that resonated with me. I could see myself in that world more than in a big company. Having said that, I benefited a lot from having worked in a management training program at Huntington Bank, so they exposed me to a lot, and I learned. It was kind of like an MBA, you know. Mm-hmm. You know. So, when Pat came back from Chicago, that we worked up the first business plans. And our dad was obviously a big influence as well. You asked about influence. We're a family of nine, and he was a son of Irish immigrants and became a very successful tax lawyer in the city. And so very sharp guy and wonderful father and grandfather. But he was very much involved with reviewing our discussions about all this, helped out financially at the beginning. And so that was a godsend, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, he said, you know, I don't know anything about the beverage industry, but I have people that I know that are, and he said, if you don't mind, why don't we have lunch and just meet this person and get his spin on it, and we did. And this particular person said, this is the worst idea. First of all, your sons have no industry experience either in breweries or restaurants, and breweries are closing by the hour, and restaurants close by the minute. So I don't think this is worth gambling on. And so I remember walking through the valley just hours, just totally deflated, because I thought it was well thought out and it needed to be tweaked, but it seemed to me a concept whose time had come. So I went over to his house that night and said, well, thanks, Dad, for setting up the luncheon, but, you know, that I have to say that was a bummer, to say the least. He said, no. He said, I thought you handle each negative with a positive. So he says, it's obvious you did your homework. So he said, if you want to get going, I could step in and help with the project.
Awesome.
Which totally blew me away.
Awesome.
So
family affair.
Yeah, he also, you know, back then there was no microbreweries in the state yet. Mm-hmm. We were the first one. And so the laws were needing to be navigated. And John Drain was his friend who was a lawyer who specialized in alcohol law. And he worked with us to help navigate those laws and prove to them that this was something that was within the law that could be done. It didn't need any change. But it was crazy, right? Remember, they say, well, in order to get a brewery, you have to give us this was for the federal government, I think. You have to give us the products that you're going to make. And we're like, well, how do we give us the products we're going to make when we don't have a brewery to make?
Yeah, chicken and an egg.
Right. So we, our master brewer, who I'm sure you'll hear about, knew of a place in Chicago, which was the Siebel Institute of Brewing, and they had their own little pilot system and lab, and so we gave them our ideas for the Dortmunder, or back then it was the Heisman, and the Elliott Ness, and so they produced the samples that we could send to the government to allow us to get our license.
Wow. Yeah. So you worked really hard. This didn't happen overnight, obviously.
Actually,
and you had
the person that referred us to Siebel's was his name, Thane Johnson. He was a retired brewmaster. Mm-hmm. And when we came back from Chicago, I looked under B for brewers in the phone book. That's when they had phone books.
Mm-hmm.
And there were but there was a brewer and soft drink union. So we called them and I said to you, is there any of the brewers left? They said, no, they're all closed. But Thane Johnson ran the last one, Schmitz Brewery, and he's retired living in Sagamore Hills. So I went out and walked in and I said, hey, I've got this idea. My brother and I are thinking of doing this. And he said, well, you know, I was brewed for 40 or 50 years and I'm now retired and I'd rather not invest in another brewery. But he said, if you want to hire me as a consultant. And so if it hadn't been for that meeting and him saying yes, I'm not sure where we would have gone, because he was an extraordinary, wonderful person and a great brewer. But it was because of Thane, who was a lager brewer, that we went with the Heisman, Dortmunder Gold, mm-hmm. and the Elliott Ness, because those were two lager beers.
And he brought his engineer along, too.
He said, well, we went out to see some breweries in California, because California was way ahead of the Midwest, and we looked at this place and that place, and then we were flying back to Cleveland, and he said, somewhere over the Rocky Mountains, he said, you know what, I think we ought to build our own brewery. Because he said, I know a guy named Charlie Price who ran the Schmitz Brewery, and he could help design it. So Thane and Charlie sat down at a round table with us, and they designed the breweries. And they designed our second brewery, and they designed our third brewery.
Wow. And did Thane come up with a recipe then for the Dortmunder Lager that won the gold medal, the Heisman?
Yeah, he did. And he, you know, there's not so much input from Charlie Price, because he was the brewing engineer on the formulas, the recipes, but Thane was encouraged by the idea of the Dortmunder, because it was very balanced lager. It had a nice malt backbone and then a nice fine hop finish, and it wasn't a porter and it wasn't an IPA and it wasn't more of these esoteric beers with spices, because we thought we needed to get an entree into the craft world, but let's do something that's more receptive to the Midwest palate, and so that's why we chose those styles.
I hope you enjoyed these two episodes of Brewing for Good as much as Greg and I enjoyed recording them. To learn more about the sustainability efforts and history of Great Lakes Brewing Company, visit greatlakesbrewing.com. Be sure to plan a visit to their brew pub in Ohio City to sample all the great seasonal beers they have on tap. I highly recommend the Oktoberfest and the Pretzel Stout. Finally, if you like what you're hearing on EcoSpeak CLE, please share our podcast with your friends. New episodes will be available twice a month. And to stay up to date, please follow EcoSpeak CLE on Facebook and Instagram.